There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm Mel McLaughlin. Welcome to No Turning Back, the Tokyo 2020 podcast. It's been a long 5-year wait, but the Tokyo Olympic and Paralympic Games are finally happening and there is no turning back now. In this series, I'll be meeting some of the athletes going for gold in Tokyo and sharing their stories. In this episode, not many athletes get to 4 Paralympics, let alone before they turn 30. Maddie Di Rosario really is the Wonder Woman of the Paralympic team. From racing the grueling marathon to gracing magazine covers, Maddie makes it all look effortless and glamorous. Maddie, thanks so much for chatting to us, especially at this time and things are getting very serious. You're off to your 4th Paralympic Games. How does that sit with you? Obviously, you are so young for your first one.
It's strange to think about. Like I feel like I've been in this sport for so long, for half my life now, at, you know, on national teams, and it's weird to think of it as a 4th Games. And I think that each one doesn't get less nerve-wracking. I think as I got older, I thought I would get more used to it, more familiar with what that would feel like. But I think when you pull on the green and gold at a Games, it's so different from anything else that you do. And that feeling, I think, in my experience, has not changed since I was 14.
Half your life. That's a sobering reality. That's, yeah, I don't know how many people could say that.
Yeah, I was thinking about this the other day because I was 14 in Beijing.
What did you think when you were 14 and you went over?
It was the most overwhelming experience of my life. I think still, I so vividly remember walking into the Bird's Nest, the opening ceremony. It's the only opening ceremony at a Games that I've actually been to, and I'm so glad that I did, that I got that experience. But I think being there amongst, you know, 400, you know, of your family, basically, at that point, and kind of walking into that stage, and then knowing that that's where you're going to be racing for the Games, and that's, I think, one of the cool things about athletics is where you walk out the opening ceremonies, where you'll be competing for those Games. And that's quite a cool experience. And I remember walking out into this stadium with the entire Australian team and you couldn't see anything. It was just the flashing lights of cameras that you kind of see in those dramatic scenes in movies. I never think you'll experience in real life. And I just remember being overwhelmed by every single part of that experience, the dining hall, the village, all of that. But every moment I was on the track was so intense and so extreme. And I think getting to share that with my teammates in the relay kind of at the end there was a really cool experience as well. I think getting to win a medal on that track with 3 of my teammates was unreal.
Yeah, well, you've been so successful at the 3 Paralympic Games so far with the silver medals. Do you have a favourite Olympic Games?
My favourite? Oh, that's a hard one. They're all so different and they've all been. Rio was my most successful Games by far as an individual athlete, and I think even the events that I didn't medal in, that the 5000 that I raced in Rio is one of the best races I've ever run in my life, and everything I had in me on the day I gave, and that got me a 4th place, and that was the best I was going to do. But tactically, I ran the best possible race that I could have run. And so I love that moment, that experience. But London as a Games was unreal. That was the most incredible, I think, Games as a whole. But it was also my worst performances. I was devastated with how I performed in London. And then kind of Beijing holds a completely separate space for me. So I wouldn't be able to pick a favourite. They've all been so different.
What about London? You know, I was there for the Olympic side of things. But I remember for the Paralympics, yeah, my family's English over there. They all said that there was nothing like the Paralympic Games and the feeling around town. It was way better. And it was already great for the Olympics, but way better for some reason.
I think that there is this energy that comes with the Paralympics. I've been on able-bodied teams, mixed teams, and Paralympic teams. And the energy at all three is very different. And I'm incredibly biased when I say this, but the Paralympic is my favorite. I think there is, I don't know, I think there is a sense of community and family. And I think there's an additional layer of purpose that I think comes with the Paralympic Games. I think that we're all incredibly aware that sport is one of the biggest platforms that people with disabilities are ever able to get at the moment. And it's frustrating that that is how it works, but I think we're all very aware of that. And so I think we're there selfishly to race and give everything out there on the track or the road or whatever it is. But I think there's also this understanding that you are able to use that small moment in the spotlight to make a very, very big impact. And I know that every single one of us take that responsibility incredibly seriously and do everything we can with that. So I think there is this kind of community and purpose that comes with that. And I love that about my Paralympic family. I hate that we have to do that. I don't love that that's the situation that we all find ourselves in. I wish that my teammates could just be athletes selfishly with no responsibility kind of applied to that. But I love that every single one of them grabs onto it with both hands and wants to do everything they can with that platform.
Well, having someone like you as a spokesperson the way you are and speaking the way you do, that I know you're big on, you know, what's you're wanting to normalise and what not to normalise. And that's really important, isn't it?
Yes, I think that normalizing is at the heart of all of it. Easing that discomfort that we want to feel around disability is huge. And sport is one of the most pervasive industries that we have. I think sport and the arts, the two huge ones. And so we don't have many opportunities where we see people with disabilities as something other than that identity. I think we want to apply it no matter what that person is doing. And that's quite a dehumanizing lens that we view people through. Whereas sport, because it's so impactful and we understand it, we can empathize that experience because we've all participated in sport on some level, we kind of see right through disability quicker than we do with most other things. So I think sport has this opportunity to have quite a significant impact. And again, I definitely train, compete and race very selfishly, but I'm aware of what I want to do with my platform that I am afforded because of sport. And yeah, I think a lot of us do take that very seriously.
Yeah, as you say, with a big, beautiful smile on your face, but yeah, it's a very serious matter. I think there's nothing like the Paralympics of anything in the world. Nothing highlights more that it's more than just sport, just the meaning of, you know, I don't think you see more tears than you do in the stands or at home or goosebumps than watching the Paralympic Games. And yeah. I don't mean that in any form of condescending way.
No.
It's people who just look at what anyone can do.
Yeah, and I think that there are moments where we embrace everyone from every single corner of our community, and we do it on every level throughout our days, always. And I think Paralympic Games is a moment where we stop and we see that. And I think that, you know, how we've viewed disability has changed so much. And I think it can be so relatable. I think obviously with disability is quite an obvious mold that you don't fit into. I think whether it's you know, physically, societally, environmentally, like I think you're forced to kind of recognize that. And I think we all see parts of ourselves in not 100% fitting in. And I think so often every single person will change who they are to try and fit the mold that society creates for us. And that's just not possible as a person with a disability, because no matter how much you change yourself, it's never going to be enough to fit the mold. It's not physically possible. So I think a lot of people with disabilities, and we see it at the Paralympics, is just a bunch of humans just rewriting the entire narrative. And I think that kind of gives us such an insight of how to do that as individuals, whether we belong to any minority group or whichever minority group it is that we belong to. We kind of see that in action at a Paralympic Games, and we see it through the lens of sport, which is incredible, but I think we can apply that to every single part of our lives. And I think that's one of the reasons I think we love the Paralympics so much, is we see, I think, the entire spectrum of humanity kind of in one space for the course of 10 days.
I loved hearing obviously everyone, but led by Kurt Fearnley, just talking about this mob, how everyone loves being part of this the mob.
It is. It's
5 years ago now.
Yeah, it's a family. And that's been one of the hardest parts about the last 18 months, is I'm so used to seeing them so often throughout. And you're kind of just surrounded by people who I think have this, there's a sense of like forced intimacy that happens at a Paralympics where you're all at your most stressed, your most anxious, your most, I think, vulnerable, surrounded by people sharing that exact same experience. And so I think you bond pretty hard with these people, whether you've met them before or not. And I think that there is definitely a sense of family about that. And whether you're a current athlete, former athlete, staff, whatever it is, I don't think that goes away. I know like our retired athletes are still 100% a part of that family. And there is definitely a sense of that in the Paralympic family.
I read an article, I think, I remember it's from years ago, and you talking about, I think it was after going to a Paralympic Games, I'm not sure which one, where you fully appreciated your body and you talked about having the perfect body and the reasons why it's perfect.
I think that's such a big one, because I think it's something that we all struggle with as humans. And I...
Everyone does, yeah.
Every single person. And I empathise, particularly with young girls. I think that's such a... it's huge. And there's just so much pressure on how you're meant to present. And again, it falls into that idea of, as soon as I think you're a girl or a woman, that becomes quite a large part of your identity, whether you want it to be or not. And that's an impossible mold to fit, because it doesn't fit any person. And so I think for me as a girl growing up with a disability, you're in a body that's never going to be society's idea of perfect. And while you don't necessarily logically believe that as a human, as a person, you still internalize everything that you've ever seen or heard or believed. And that's so hard to shake. And I was able to shake that because of sport. I think once you become an athlete, there is this respect that you have to have for your body. If you want it to achieve everything that you need it to, you're going to be putting it through the most ridiculous life, and you're going to be demanding so much of it and expecting so much of it. And I think if you actually want to be able to do that, you need to also be nurturing and respecting and looking after it. And those two things don't work together. I think deciding you hate your body as a young girl for whatever reason doesn't work with sport. And I had the privilege of using sport to overcome that barrier that I had around myself. And we don't all have sport to be able to do that. And it's kind of recognizing that your body is I fell in love with my body because of what it could do for me. But I think if the only thing that your body does is provide a home, then that's enough as well. And we don't give our bodies enough credit for that. So I think body image is a huge obstacle for so many of us, because we expect too much of it. Our body is our home, and that's all it needs to be.
People are just never going to be happy in that regard. It seems we're never happy. I loved something where you said somewhere where, you know, your upper body and how strong it is. And you saw a photo of your back and said, yeah, my back looks good.
It's one part of myself that I never actually see. And so I think when you see those photos, those campaigns, I think it almost doesn't feel like yours, because you never actually see it. And I am proud of everything that my body has been able to do. And I can't believe you found that quote. That's so embarrassing.
It's a good one. No, because we do, you're like, oh, my arm looks good there. For me, I'm like, I don't like my arms. Oh, looks all right there.
No, exactly. Yeah. Right? I think we 100% do that.
Yeah. Do you consider yourself, just further to that, do you consider yourself a trailblazer? You are, but are you aware that you're a trailblazer for many reasons?
I think I know that I try and use every opportunity I have in a spotlight to do the best I possibly can. And I think you don't necessarily see the impact that you have while you're in that space doing it, because it feels like a bit of an uphill. I think it never feels like you're going to be able to do enough. Like I would love to see us get to a point where young kids with disabilities don't have to justify the space that they take up. And I think it takes us so long to get to a point where we choose to not justify. And it's a decision that we make. And I was only able to do it through very specific circumstances, through sport, and getting to kind of shed that identity that I thought was going to be my life and become everything and anything that I wanted to be, an entire person who I am. And that didn't happen for me until my late teens, early 20s. And I know people that it's so much later than that, and some people who are never able to do that because we're so, I think, entrenched in stigma. And I would love to see a point where we don't have to have my, I don't want my community to have to constantly be going through that. I would love young boys and girls with disabilities to grow up believing that they're an entire human. They don't have to lean into that stigma and be anything and everything they want to be, and not just what they've been shaped to be and led to believe.
So obviously, you know, you're inspirational with what you do as an athlete. But, you know, going back to the great back, for example, I don't know anyone that takes a better photo than you, can I just say, if you just look at all the stuff that you do. So you've got some sponsorships as well. You're very beautiful. I don't want to get creepy. Is that creepy? I don't know. No, it's true. And it's, you know, Under Armour, for example, seeing you in those photo shoots, for example, what sort of feedback do you get? Because obviously anyone can wear Under Armour, but what feedback do you get as to what that means to people? You talk about this community.
I think that big brands with bigger platforms than the individual is ever going to have the capacity to amplify voices, brighten that spotlight, lift up that platform. And Under Armour has done that for me. And they've also allowed me to kind of take the lead on what I want that to look like, which I think is so important. And there is this kind of balance you want to strike where you want to show that I am in a wheelchair, that, you know, my racing chair and all, you want to show the disability because it's a part of who
and
I
look,
am.
You look fierce. Thank as well. You. Like, in the best possible way.
But you want to show all of that. You want to show an entire person because I think we often either shy away completely from disability or we lean into it as an entire identity. And it's that balance you have to strike because it's a big part of who I am. And I'm incredibly proud of who I am as a woman with a disability. And so I want all of that showcased. I think it's the difference between representation and visibility. I think representation it's a little tokenistic. I think we've all dealt with it as women. Mm. I think we all deal with it no matter what minority we belong to.
That is a whole other chat.
Oh, it's a whole other chat. But I think that we do this thing where if you're then a representation capacity, it's tokenistic. Mm. And your entire identity becomes who you're representing, the entire community representing. And that's not fair on the individual and it's not fair on the community because they're kind of seeing a person representing them, who they look like, and all they're seeing is that is their entire identity, and that's my entire identity. Whereas visibility is showing a person all of their facets and all of their humanity and accepting all of it. And so you're doing two things. You're showing 20% of Australians with disabilities that they can be an entire person and not their entire identity reduced to the stigma of disability. You're showing the 80% an entire person as well. And we're so shaped by what surrounds us as the 20%. We need that 80% to see us in all of our facets. And so we need it in the media. We need it, you know, as bright as possible. And brands like Under Armour are the ones that are able to make that change. And I love that everyone who I work with leans into that so strongly and lets myself or whoever they're working with really shape that narrative. And so I would not be able to have the impact that I'm able to have through sport without that kind of support. So I'm unbelievably grateful for it.
What about Barbie? Talk to me about Barbie.
That's still the most surreal. I don't even know how to, it's been a year now and more than a year, and I still don't know how to wrap my head around. That's the highest compliment I've ever been paid, I think.
Explain what happened.
You're
a Barbie.
I'm a Barbie doll. I have the Barbie doll of myself in my house. It feels strange to see that every day. So Barbie makes a Shiro doll every year where they pick one woman and make a one-of-a-kind doll in her image. And it's not just necessarily about what she's achieved in her profession or industry, but about the impact that she's able to have and the alignment of values. And so, the doll is a very cool part of it. But it's kind of the whole story and how big that platform that Barbie has is to kind of want to help you tell your story. And through so many different outlets as well, it was kind of used in so many different spaces that had quite a significant reach. And then to kind of, you know, and it's the highest compliment because I know the women athletes in Australia and I know the options that Barbie had. And so to be chosen, I still can't wrap my head around that. It's incredibly flattering. But to be able to, the fact that a brand chose an athlete with a disability as the athlete that they wanted to embody sport in Australia in 2020 is significant. It just on its own, the fact.
It's enormous.
Yes. And I love that happened. And Barbie globally had multiple Paralympic athletes in the Shiro campaign for 2020. And that's huge. That's so impactful. And it's such an authentically diverse brand, which is, you know, of something I align with so heavily. And so I think to again get to kind of speak directly to young girls, I think is huge because that's where that formation starts and that kind of sense of identity. And we lose our identity so young, I think, as girls. And so to kind of have any impact on that is, I mean, that's all any of us really want to do.
It's exhausting, isn't it?
It is.
It's a very heavy and very true point that you raise. But, okay, further to that, Cosmo Sportswoman of the Year as well, a couple of years ago.
It's getting so uncomfortable.
I know, isn't it? Isn't it? I'd hate this in reverse. No, actually, I'd love it, just quietly.
That was also an incredibly high honour because that was a public vote as well, which I think was one of the coolest parts about that, I think, to, and I mean, arguably that was the best year I've had as an athlete. That was after Comm Games and London Marathon. And so to kind of wrap the year up with that, it was huge. I think that, I mean, yeah, I think, the public voting on that makes that mean so much more to me than if it was kind of just done anything else, because I think that's one of the trickiest things to, I think, not deal with, that seems harsh, but kind of make peace with, is how you're still perceived. And so I think to be perceived by the public as an athlete and Cosmo's Athlete of the Year is pretty significant. So, yeah, no, that's pretty special to me as well.
And I didn't just bring that up so I could link that to when you came in here, we talked about how we may know each other, and you just casually said, you say it because
that we've been in Vogue together.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you said it because I would never have brought that up. But it's funny that we both had the same thing. It was a special that they did on, I guess, sports. I don't know.
Women in sport. Well, yeah.
It's obviously not athletes because I was there. So, but yeah, women in sport. And you and I both said we both had the same thought. What are we doing in there? Isn't 100%. That funny? That's just how we feel.
I think you just immerse yourself in work, and we do it because we love it, and you kind of just do it. And so when I think recognitions kind of come along, it's kind of jarring because you're kind of just trying to do the best you can.
It's Vogue.
I know.
So I'm just laughing thinking about it. In hindsight, yeah. You just casually brushed over 2018. Oh, blah, 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 was my best year. Oh, yeah, just gold at the Commonwealth Games. And, oh, then I just, you know, ducked over to London and won that marathon as well. So not much in that year. Let's go Gold Coast first. That experience, I was lucky enough to be up there and, you know, just experience, you know, the buzz and everything. And, you know, what everyone said was they just loved how, I don't know how you feel, you know, how inclusive it was. Mm. Everyone was part of it. And I think a lot of people learnt from that as well. Did you feel that way?
Absolutely. And I think that we love Paralympic sport when we see it. It's hard not to. And I think that there are so many individuals that we fall in love with every time we watch it. The personalities again, I'm very biased, but the personalities of my teammates, like, stand out. They're incredible humans that you want to invest in, follow their journeys. And I think to see that at a home Comm Games really kind of allow people kind of an insight into our sport and who we are. And I think that going forward, we have I hear quite a bit, like, why aren't the Paralympics and the Olympics combined events like they are at Comm Games? And the reality is at Comm Games, they're not truly combined. We kind of have a couple of events. So I'll race 4 events at the Paralympic Games. 2 of my events are available at Commonwealth Games. And they were the only 2 wheelchair racing events. So there is so much more than just what we got to see. And it really is just kind of a showcase. And if people watch that and fall in love with it, I want them to watch the Paralympics because you can. It's so readily available. And you'll see so much more of all of that. And it's not about combining the two because it's a logistical impossibility. Mm. It would be... Yeah. Absolutely impossible, but you can watch and invest in both just as easily, and that's kind of what I want to see is you know, Angie Ballard was second in that 1500 at Commonwealth Games, and she's the former 400 800 meter world record holder, but we didn't get to see all of her best events because they weren't available. But you can see her best events at a Paralympics. You can see every single Australian athlete in their absolute best events in their element, and I want the Australian public to get to experience that because it's something. It's special, and I think you'll fall in love with the sport, with the team, with everything.
That gold medal, that experience. What do you remember of that day? It was very hot, at least most of the time, from memory.
Yeah, and the marathon particularly was one of the warmest ones we've had. That works well for I think most Australians. So I think we have a bit of a benefit with that. But I don't remember the actual 1500. I remember crying on the bus on the way to the track. I remember being so overwhelmed.
On the way to the track.
I wasn't even there yet. I was in the village still in our apartment, and I was trying to get ready, and I was crying because I was so anxious. I think I'd put so much pressure on myself to not just make the podium. I'd never gone into a race knowing that the end result I'd be happy with was winning it. That was the first for me. But I don't think I'd verbalize that at that point. But I knew that at those Commonwealth Games, I wanted to win both the 100 and the marathon. And that's all well and good when you're 6 months out planning it. When it becomes the day of to actually do that, that pressure is enormous. I was crying. And we had a really young athlete. It was her first Australian team ever. And I was obviously a senior on the team. And so she was like, I don't know how to process this. I'm like, I don't know how to process this, if that helps. This is your future. And both of my teammates who were also racing the 15 were having
don't tell me they were crying.
No, they were having me crying. They had to race as well. And I'm just ruining the experience for everyone. And I remember getting on the bus and
I don't mean to laugh, but it's a bit funny.
It's so funny. Oh my God. At the time, I was like, I recognize this is funny, but I'm having a really hard time. And I remember getting
the youngsters are going, you're supposed to fix me.
I know. Yeah. And I'm like, this is what it looks like. And I remember getting on the bus to get to the track, and one of the brands that I work with had put my face on the buses, and I drove past this, and the pressure that I've been avoiding any kind of all of that.
Yeah.
But obviously you have to see it if your face drives past you on a bus. And I remember starting to cry on the bus again.
When you saw your...
Yep, which is a whole different level of narcissism,
and they
I guess.
Just calmed you down and you're off again.
But then the moment
it's
the gun
not narcissism,
went,
is it?
I mean, if you it's see... if I don't know, man. Like, I don't know how...
Most people don't cry when they... Well,
that's... Yeah. It's jarring. And I remember... Yeah. But once the
it's incredible, actually.
Gun went, yeah. I remember just feeling completely calm. And the minute that it's time to race, like I know exactly what I'm doing and how to race. And there's this kind of silence that happens and you kind of just start moving through the motions. And I think your body kind of just switches to knowing what it has to do and kind of just going through that process. And I remember that kind of silence, the whole 1500 and then crossing the line. And it was so surreal because like the sound kind of just came flooding back. And I think doing that in a stadium of Australians was nothing like anything I've ever experienced before. And I think when we travel, you put on the green and gold and you know that you have an entire nation backing you, but you don't have a visual to accompany that. And so I think one of the coolest things I now have when I travel to race is I do have that. I think, you know, I raced at a Worlds the following year in Dubai, and I think you're in the green and gold and you kind of have that sense of you're representing something bigger than yourself. And I know what that would feel like to be surrounded by that, which makes that whole experience so much more special. So I'm so grateful for that experience, not just for the opportunity at the time, but I think what that means to me going forward.
I think, I don't know if it was, it might have been after this race, you posted a photo and you kind of, you've got your arm over I think your forehead, and you said, Mum asked if I was dabbing, and you're like, I'm crying, woman.
Yes! My mum is like, she's on my social media just commenting like slightly shady stuff all the time, which I love. But it's pretty nonstop, and that was one of them. She was there in the stadium when that happened. She knows I was crying, and that's still her little social media input. And I'm like, yeah, no,
so
woman.
She's amusing herself.
100%.
Love it. Okay, and then going over to London, winning the marathon, as we said, pretty decent 2018 for you. What about that experience? Did you cry before that race, or were you all good?
I was petrified. That was a shock. I think going back into that race, I definitely wasn't expecting to win. And since then, that's the only major that I've won. I've managed to kind of find myself on the podium a few times.
It must have been a huge thrill. It's
yeah.
So prestigious.
Yeah. And I think that was also in like a kind of strange, I guess, turn of events. That's the first marathon I ever did in 2013. Like London Marathon was the first marathon that I raced. And so for it to be the first one that I won 5 years later was really cool. And I actually, full disclosure, only won it because I wasn't familiar with the course. So it's quite a flat course. Everyone stays together throughout the marathon. So we kind of ended up with six of us in a sprint finish. And my goal going in was I wanted to make top five. I thought I was in a, you know, physical space to be able to do that. And it was a hugely competitive field. And coming in with like about only a kilometer to go, there were six of us still together. And I was like, all I have to do is like beat one person and I can, you know, reach that goal that I'd set. And I remember kind of thinking like, who should I try and, you know, who is this one person? And they give you a countdown once it's a kilometer to go, so 900 meters, 800 meters. And I don't have a good short sprint. I kind of need to really build up and do quite a long kick. And the last part of London Marathon is quite, there's like a bunch of 90 degree turns basically. And so I didn't realize that there was kind of this unwritten thing, unspoken thing that you kind of wait until the last kind of straightaway to kind of really start that final sprint. And I wasn't familiar enough with the course to know there were that many more turns coming up that was kind of what everyone else was planning on doing. And so when I saw the 600 meters to go kind of marker, I knew that I had to go, because that's kind of usually my indication to myself that's kind of the sprint that I need. So I kind of just put my head down and went. A really small gap opened up on the inside of one of the turns, and I took it, and I managed to hold it. And it was a huge surprise to me. I know it was a surprise to everyone back home and who I was racing as well. But yeah, I definitely wasn't expecting that result by any means.
That's amazing. Just not being familiar with the course, and that has worked in your favour.
Yeah, and I think that's big though. I think there was a big learning curve for me, and it was nice to have a learning curve with success at the end of it. I think you should learn from mistakes instead. But I think to back my own race strategy, my own strengths and weaknesses, mm-hmm. I think is really important, and not kind of be have your own race dictated by who's around you or necessarily the course or the environment, and really kind of backing your own ability and what you need to do to race. And that's something we definitely carry forward in all of our events.
Is that a photo with Prince Harry after that?
Yeah, that was the part my mum was most excited about, yeah, as well, of all of that.
People love the world. Well, obviously, situations have changed, yes, since then, but that's, again, a whole other podcast.
We've
got about 10 to record, I think, after this one. Okay, so talking about training, your coach, Louise Sauvage, who's, you know, obviously an absolute legend. I'll just I'll give her a call, and I don't have a number, but a sample. I'll give her a call and just say, just don't educate her on any courses, because that's obviously a good omen.
100%.
As I say, she's a legend. What is that like? You two seem like a bit of a dream team.
We've put a lot of work into being a really good, cohesive team, I think, and a lot of it is credit to Louise. I think that as someone who's come from the same sport, same events as I now do, and had so much success, I think it's so easy to have this idea of what that looks like, what that process looks like. And to you and I are very different as athletes. The one thing we have in common is we do the same events. That's practically it. And I think Lou would line up for a race and she would win it because she wanted to, because she was the most competitive person. She was so fiery, and she's definitely a win at all costs. She would do whatever it takes. And she's, I think when we think of an athlete and that mentality, that is Louise Sauvage. She embodies every single part of that. And I don't. And it almost had me quitting the sport after the London Games. I didn't think I had what it took to be as successful as I wanted to be in the sport. And everyone around me was this kind of fiery, driven, competitive, wanted to beat who they were lining up alongside. And I couldn't switch my mindset to want those things. And it was Louise, despite everything she is and was as an athlete, who kind of helped me through that. And it was this kind of idea of, we worked out who I needed to be as an athlete, what my processes were and what I required from her. And she's the one that kind of created a space for me to work out who I was as an athlete. I think because I started so young, I was just trying to emulate every single person around me. And so it wasn't until I was 18, 19, after my second games, that I really took the time to work out who I was as a person and therefore as an athlete. And she's the one that held that space for me and gave me every single support possible to work out who I was. And I think the best way to summarize it is, we don't go into a race with plans to win. We don't necessarily set a time that we're going to achieve, who we're going to be, or, you know, an order we want to cross that line in. We set 2 to 4 really small goals. And if we can execute each of those things, I'm set up to run the best possible race. And if I run the best possible race and I bring everything physically, mentally, emotionally to the track or the road, I have the potential to be the best in the world on that day in that on that track. And so it's not about that final goal, because I just don't have it in me. I think I'm just in awe of my competitors to a point that it frustrates Louise that I do this. But we kind of break,
she wants you to own your own
exactly
space and how good you are. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And she definitely does that better than I do, and she does it for me better than I do. But so we break the race down instead, and we kind of move through those steps. And if I execute every single one of those and don't cross that finish line first, it's not a fault on my part, it's a credit to whoever did cross that line first, because I gave everything that I was able to. And that's why that 5,000 in Rio means so much to me, because I did execute the perfect race. Every goal we set, we achieved perfectly. I just wasn't the best athlete on the track on that day, and I'm completely at peace with that. And I think that's the approach that we now have, and it's in contrast to who Lou was, an athlete, but she's the one that helped me to create that space.
Yeah, what a great outlook as well. Did COVID affect you in a good or bad way?
Both. I think in terms of actually racing. So we're quite lucky to be an outdoor individual sport. We were able to get a lot of our training still done. We obviously didn't have gym access or access to our indoor training facilities, but I was still able to, I didn't have to take time off during lockdown, which is a blessing. But I think that one of the hardest things to, I guess, for me to process is at a games, it doesn't matter how good or how fast you are. It just matters what order you cross that finish line in. And that's not really how most of us approach sport. I think that constant improvement doesn't lend itself to that goal necessarily. And yeah. So the Worlds previously, we had quite a short turnaround between 2019 World Champs in November to games in August. And so we were initially nervous about that turnaround. It's hard to back up a Worlds to a Games in only 10 months. What happened at World Championships, though, is I won the 800 by the biggest margin that I've ever won a race in what would be a full Paralympic field. And so that 10 months suddenly became a huge advantage to myself, because for my competitors to close that gap, it was going to take quite a big amount of work. And that kind of gave me a lot of peace of mind going into Paralympics. I think just your ranking does not matter, is how you can actually execute a race. And that margin, I think, was significant. And that was kind of going to be a huge advantage to me going into Tokyo. And so that's kind of gone now. And I don't know how my competitors are racing. I don't know how I'm racing, because I haven't raced internationally since 2019. So it's hard to kind of... It's a long time. So it's kind of hard to work out where I am. So on that part, the physical part is challenging. But I think we've also been able to take time to mentally work at how you want to approach sport. I think as athletes, we're very reactive to stuff. I think a good race or a bad race, you process it after it's done, and you're putting yourself in a position to process it well. We just don't do, because there's so many other things that kind of take priority over it. So I spent so much time this last 2 years in a room with my psych and my coach, working out how to best be mentally prepared for everything that's going to happen, and being flexible and happy to change as things go. So I think in terms of that, that's an opportunity that we probably will never get again. So I think we definitely kind of capitalized on the time that we had. So it's definitely both. It's been good and bad, and I'm kind of looking forward to seeing how it all plays out.
Given all of that, and I suppose the positive is everyone's in the same boat, what are the expectations? What goal are you setting for yourself over there?
Ooh, it's a big question.
You don't have to answer.
I was about to give you my standard media answer of just do our best, win our best. Sport's the real winner. I am going into the 800 as the current world record holder. So that's obviously quite, I've never done that before. And it's kind of feeling quite similar to how Comm Games felt, where I think the 800 specifically, I think I would be devastated with a silver medal. Whether that is going to happen or not, maybe we'll all watch me race at 100 in Tokyo and witness my heartbreak in real time. I don't know how that's going to go. We'll all be on that journey together. But the 800, I definitely have very high goals. So it's my most consistent event.
World record holder.
Yes. The 15 and 5,000 are hard, because they're so tactical. So much of it, any time I've done well in those events, it's not been because I was the fastest or the strongest. It's because tactically I ran a smart race. And any 5,000, that's how the result plays out. It's who just races tactically the best. And so it's hard. We're also out of practice in that. So I don't know what these races are going to look like. So planning for them has been really challenging. And it's going to be something we do in the village, I think, once we see everyone else kind of racing and how they're moving. So I don't know what those events are going to look like. And again, the marathon, I haven't done 42K since, November of 2019. So we'll see.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Switching to Shopify helps you sell smarter at every stage of your business. Take full control of your brand with your own custom online store.
Wow, looks amazing.
Find more customers with our easy-to-use marketing tools.
Piece of cake.
And let the best converting checkout on the planet do its thing. Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Switch to Shopify today for a $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.
You'll be fine. I thought about it. You'll be totally fine. you talk about the village. Are you I know it'll look different, but excited to get back in there?
I am. I think that you kind of go into this this space where you're surrounded by so many people with a shared goal. And I think we're all, I think in our real lives, we're trying to balance every part of our lives. And for us, I think sport and training obviously takes priority, but you're trying to do everything else. And I think that once you're in that village, you can kind of take the time to just focus on your sport, and that becomes everything for 2 weeks. And so I'm looking forward to that experience again. And then being surrounded by, you know, so thousands of people who are just as driven, just as I think there for the same reasons. And that's quite a unique experience, going to get to be surrounded by that. So I'm definitely looking forward to all of that.
Is there anything that you pack? Is there any food that you need to take that, you know, say from Aussie food, you know, Milo, whatever, that you can't leave home without?
I'm that person that travels with my coffee machine. Your coffee machine. I'm so embarrassed. It's like a little Nespresso machine. Like, it's not like I'm bringing, but we've been told not to bring electronics because it might shut down the power in the whole town. Yes. Or the thing. So I've been told specifically not to bring half my kitchen like I usually do.
Will they not have them?
They will.
But maybe not in your room.
Yeah, exactly. And I think.
So you're definitely taking that.
I've gone and tried to look online for ones that don't require power, like what kind of manual coffee machines. I found a bunch of options. So I'm like, I was online the other day kind of buying tiny coffee machines, like an AeroPress, yeah, which I now have. I kind of travel with basically everything I'm going to need day of routine. I think that's where I find a lot of calm on race days, doing the exact same things in my process. So basically anything that can help to kind of make that run as smoothly as possible, I'll try and bring.
What's that like at a massive event like an Olympics, when you sort of head out into the stadium, you like go up the tunnel or whatever and you just look out?
One of the most nerve-wracking things is you can normally see the track while the event before you is on. And I think in quorum is about 45 minutes, and it's the most overwhelmingly stressful part. I think when you're warming up and getting ready, you can actively do stuff to distract yourself and kind of ground yourself in the present moment. Once you're in quorum, that's all gone. You're also allowed anything to distract you in quorum, like no phones, no music, nothing. So you're kind of just there, surrounded by the women that you're about to try and race, while they're all having the same experience, about to go out there. And then as you're about to go out on the track, you're kind of track side while that last event is on. And watching that is, it's so overwhelming. And you kind of see the whole spectrum. You see someone who just won a gold medal at Paralympic Games, and then you see someone who obviously, you know, is having their heart broken in real time as well. And you see all of that, and you don't know which one you're about to be in the next 5 minutes. So I think
sounds terrifying.
It is terrifying. It is absolutely terrifying, that moment.
We mentioned your mum. What are your family gonna do? Because obviously no one can come over. What's the story? Some people are planning little parties or to be together, or, you know, what's the story, do you know?
I actually don't know, to be honest. My family's all in Perth, and so thankfully the time zone works out really, really well for them to sort of watch stuff as it's happening. So yeah, no, I know they're all in. My mum is devastated. She had her tickets booked. Yeah. She had her tickets booked before I was selected on the team. She's been ready before I've been ready.
That's a sad part though, isn't it? That obviously everyone wants to go see their kids go.
Definitely.
Paralympians.
Yeah.
On the bigger stage.
So my mum and one of my sisters were going to come. So obviously they won't now. But yeah, I think like having that support from back home still means the world.
All right. Well, we like to ask, to sort of wrap things up, what you're most looking forward to when you land. Do you know what date you fly over?
20th of August.
20th of August. Of course, you know, it's in your brain, as it should be. Fair enough. What are you most looking forward to about, you know, when you land? Could be anything.
I'm so looking forward to racing, to getting to do, I think, what I love again. It's been so long since, I know I talk about how stressed I get before I'm racing, and I'm not looking forward to that part of it. But there is this moment when you're racing where it kind of feels like that's where I'm meant to be, and everything falls into place. And I think it's one of those moments where you feel so in control of like your body and your mind. And it's this kind of, it's unlike any other experience. You don't get it in training or in small races. You kind of only get it those big, you know, important kind of meets, and I haven't, you know, gotten to feel that in a really long time, and I'm really looking forward to that. But I honestly, I'm just so looking forward to racing again. I definitely miss that part of my life. I think that when it was taken away from all of us, I think we tell ourselves as athletes that we're well-balanced people and that sport isn't our entire identity. I've been lying to myself for like 13 years. It is 100% my identity. So I'm looking forward to getting to do that again.
Well, it is your identity, but it's plenty more as well, because you are such a spokesperson as well as CoverGirl and Barbie. What do you think? The thing is, you're so young still and got so much more to go, obviously. But do you have an idea of what you want to be known for? What you'd like your legacy to be, I guess?
I think that Australia has the potential to be one of the most authentically accepting places of every single person. And there is so much work to do in that space. And I think that work is going to take individual voices to really help shape what that looks like. And we have so far to go, and I don't know if it will happen in my lifetime, but I would like to have some impact on that landscape. I would love for this to be a place where someone can grow up and lean into every aspect of who they are as a person.
Well, you're very much already doing that. Thanks so much for chatting to us at such a busy time. Wishing you the best of luck. You just do the training, and then, as the good omens, either don't learn the track or have a big fat cry before you go out and race, and you'll be fine, okay?
I will probably do both those things.
Well, we look forward to seeing your every success over there.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to hear more incredible stories from our athletes going for gold at the Tokyo 2020 Games. You can see full coverage of the Tokyo 2020 Olympic and Paralympic Games on 7 and 7+.